Be careful when you put these things where everyone can hear. And if you find difficulty, I think some of you brethren at the back, if you can't hear, just put up your hand. It might help, or one hand anyhow, if maybe draw attention if the thing needs to be repeated. Now we're reading, as you know, from James chapter 4, and commencing in verse number 11. Speak not evil one of another, brethren. He that speaketh evil of his brother, and judges his brother, speaketh evil of the law, and judgeth the law. But if thou judge the law, thou art not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is one lawgiver, who is able to save and to destroy. Who art thou that judges another? Go to now, ye that say today or tomorrow, we will go into such a city and continue there a year, and buy and sell and get gain. For as you know not what shall be on the morrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time, and then vanisheth away. For that the opposite, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. But now ye rejoice in your boasting. All such rejoicing is evil. Therefore to him that knoweth to be good, and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Go to now, ye rich men. Weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver is cankered, and the rust of them shall be a witness against you, and shall eat your flesh as it were fire. Ye have heaped up treasure together for the last day. Behold the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields, which of you keep back by fraud? Try it, and the cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of the Vale. Ye have lived in pleasure on the earth, and been wanting. Ye have nourished your hearts as in a day of slaughter. Ye have condemned and killed the just, and he doth not resist you. Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husband not waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth, and hath long patience for it, until he receive the early and latter rain. Be ye also patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh. Judge not one against another, brethren, lest ye be condemned. Behold, the judge standeth before the door. Take my brethren the prophet, who hath spoken in the name of the Lord, for an example of suffering, affliction, and affliction. Behold, the count and happy that endure. Ye have heard of the patience of Job, and have seen the end of the Lord. But the Lord is very pitiful, and of tender mercy. But above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by earth, neither by any other oath, but let your yea be yea, and your nay, nay, lest ye fall into condemnation. Is any among you afflicted? Let him pray. Is any merry? Let him sing psalms. Is any sick among you? Let him call for the elders of the church, and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of faith shall save the sick, and the Lord shall raise him up, and if he hath committed sins, they shall be forgiven him. Confess your faults one to another, and pray one for another, that you may be healed. The effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. Elias was a man subject to like passions as we are, and he prayed earnestly that it might not rain, and it rained not on the earth by the space of 3 years and 6 months. And he prayed again, and the heaven gave rain, and the earth brought forth her fruit. Brother, if any of you the earth from the truth, and one converteth, let him know that he which converteth the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death, and shall hide a multitude of sins. I think we have already concluded that James is a unique epistle. Even the very day end, there's no final close to the epistle the way you'd expect, and the way most of the other epistles flow. And another feature about it is that it seems to be very practical, and the teachings in it were fit almost any age or at any time. I know that the church side of things comes in at the end here. But broadly speaking, the teaching has been ethical teaching that could do in any age of our time. Now, we had to close the last reading just a wee bit early, but actually, the key to what we are going to start through just now was in the closing verse of our dear brother's Bible reading. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up. Now that is a warning against pride. And you'll notice that we're going to divide the passages that we have to consider into three simple parts. We must not be very clear about that. We're going to divide it into three simple parts. And then each of these parts we will divide in two. For instance, we're going to take the first little section, and that will bring us to the evil speaking of brethren and the seeking of gain. That will take us down to verse 17. Then we're going to start in chapter 5, and we're going to look at that part, and there you have the severity of the rich, the cruel treatment of the rich, and the patient suffering that the poor are expected, or the brethren are expected to endure. The closing part of our study, which will be probably most difficult, we have sickness healed. You see, you have a man and he's healed. We'll have a look at that. And then you have sinners converted. Because if a man converts the sinner, he is doing a good work. In this part of the epistle, pray. That is one of the problems we have. And you'll notice that those who sit in judgment on others are proud of themselves, you know. And quite often their criticism of others is to bring the other person down so as to put them up. Now, he answers that matter and deals with it very plainly. And he says, now, if a man, he takes the man to be a law-keeping man, walking in the perfect law of liberty, and you sit in judgment upon it. You're not only judging a man, but you're judging the law that controls his life. So that you have actually become a judge of the law. And you know that there's only one law for us, not God. And you're putting yourself up into a pedestal like the way God, in the place that God should be in. So he says there's only one lawgiver, and you should be a doer. And not a judge. So that, I think, is the substance of that little section. And then we come to this boasting. Boasting of business success. I hope we all realize that business can be a very dangerous business. Has a strange great word in it, but that is really what we need to think. Quite a number have been in great trouble because of their business connection and their business responsibility. Now we want you to see, here's a businessman, and he has plans. And he's going to do something in a year's time. He's going to go to a certain city. He's going to stay there. He's going to make gain. He's not just going for a holiday, you know. He's going to make gain. And he's going to come home and he's going to boast. Now, I wasn't that a good joke of business. I did well. When there's this gain, that's boasting. And that's big. And that's not right. What he should say if the Lord left. Well, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. Not even what will happen in a year's time. You can't even say what's going to be tomorrow. And you're really talking far too big and far too extensive. So he says to them, that is totally wrong. Closes the chapter, you know, with he that knoweth to do good. You say, what has that to do with what has gone before? I judge that the doing good is the will of God. That's the only business we have on earth, you know that. Doing the will of God. I judge he can't get any higher up in heaven. But thy will be done on earth, as it is in heaven. So that doing the will of God is what we know we ought to do. And he that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him that is sin. That leads us to chapter 5. Here we have James going back to that solemn thought of how the rich oppress the poor, and the ill treatment of them, keeping back their wages, and even going to the length of killing them, and all that kind of suffering. Now that was going strong, mind you, at the very age when James was writing this. Those people in Judea were known all about this suffering and oppression from the this. Now, that is what bringing it down to the middle of that section, and then immediately after that, he comes to the patient endurance of the sick. What are they to do? They are to be never the patient. They're not in any way to retaliate. They're not to use crushing words against their oppressors. They're to subdue and submit to them and watch their tongue and watch their behavior. They're to be absolutely enduring temptation. They're to just bear with it and bear up under it. And with long suffering, allow these matters to be the lacking portion. He says, sure, that's very cruel. Is there no relief from that? Oh, he says, just a minute. Just a minute. You will be a good day coming. When the Lord will come. And that will settle all this. For he will be the judge and he stands at the door. He settled matter. Now the Lord's coming here is not so much stressing the wondrous benefit it will bring to the Christian, but the great fact that it will be the time when all corruption and evil will be judged by the Lord here upon earth. I judge that's the idea of the Lord's coming in the passage. It's not so much the hope of the believer, it's his judgment upon the enemies that is here stressed. Now, we come to what I suppose some of you think would be the bit that you'd want to hear more about, and that's from verse 13. And there it is there any sick among you? Any afflicted among you? Then let him pray. Now I take it that this is general affliction. Now, brother, you'll have to bear with me. You're just then here to be here from you here. You hold it down and tell you what the passage means, but I'll tell you what I think it means. Now, you can listen to it carefully and just see what's before my mind. There are always people who will be afflicted. Some have rheumatism, some have this complaint, and some have that complaint, and some have some other complaint. And we have that. Now, what do you do in those circumstances? Will you pray? Pray for God's help. Pray for God's grace. Pray for God to give you patience to bear. That's it. Then he pictures this other side of him. He says, if any sick among you. Now, I just take it that that's not just they're taking a cold or something like that. But it looks in the past. In the past. That what he has in mind is a special sickness sent for a special purpose because of certain sins in the life. That the believer has become the subject of God's dealings that has led him aside in sickness. Not to be that tickle. That's why he doesn't send for the doctor, but he sends for the elders of the church. Those who would be in touch with God and who are expected to have power in their prayers and fellowship with God. And they're to come. They're to mount a man with oil, and they're to pray over him. And the prayer of faith is to save the sick, and the Lord will heal him up. And if they commit a sin, they shall be forgiven him. That is to say, the matter is very clear. It's something that has to do with sin. Now, all sickness hasn't to do with sin. Don't be going home and saying that everybody that has the flu, that they must have done something the week before or something like that, or you said someone crossed to the wife or something like that. That's not in the passage at all. It's just simply, this is a more serious matter than that. This is something that even the person who's sick, now listen to this, knows that it has come because of what they have done. That's why they sell for the elders of the church. How about there's somebody, maybe you just can't get the elders to come or something like that, or they might be available. Well, he says, confess your faults one to another. And you can pray one for another. So you don't ever always need elders. You can pray one for another as well as the elders can pray. And then he shows us an Old Testament example of this. That there was a time when Israel departed from God. And Elijah prayed that it wouldn't rain. Now, you have no word of his prayer in the Old Testament, but it's fitting for God that he prayed. And to use Mr. Bailey's words, he used to remind us that Elijah just prayed to God, shut up the heavens and locked the door and put the key in his pocket. And then in the end of 3.5 years, he opened the door and brought the rain back down again. That is to say, he had control of the elements in fellowship with God. Now that is a case where God chastened Israel because of their sin. And because of the intercession of Elijah, those sins were forgiven after a period of time where Elijah took time to be repented before the rain came. And then when the rain came, it was an answer to his prayer. Then, in a general way again, he says, the fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. That would bring us, of course, to the end of the chapter. Brethren, if any of you do err from the truth. Now, I'm not being always, I'm not getting much support in what I believe in this, but you may bear with me. I'm going to tell you simply what I think of it. I don't make a big problem out of this at all. It's just a believer erring from the truth. And another believer in touch with God seeks to recover it. And one converteth. Let him know that he which converteth the sinner from this, that is, this man that has gone astray, from the error of his way. That is, he changes him from an erring brother into an obedient brother. He'll do two things. He shall save a soul or a person from death. Now, we're at the word soul here. It's not his soul inside him that we think it's him. It's the usual James way of language, of a sort of language. You have it in Peter. You men know it. Its souls were saved. It was more than souls were saved. It was the whole person was saved. He'll save the man from death. That is, instead of him filling an early grave, he will be spared. And his sins will be covered over and cover a multitude of sins. Very simple, of course. Yeah, far too simple. I know the late Mr. Rogers took the word death in a very serious way, and took the sinner in an equally serious way. We're not going to on dying, of course. That will be brought up, I'm sure, in the reading. But you've heard what I think. It's just quite simple. In other words, I throw it back to the early part of the chapter, where we had already a sick man and his sickness healed, and we just see it almost identical at the end. Only the question of sickness is not mentioned, it's saving from death instead. Now, I want to say a few things, and then I'll sit down, I suppose time will be enough. I want to say a few things about the epistle in general. Because, you see, it is a most interesting epistle. Now, you've noticed that our brethren have done two things already. They've spent a good bit of time connecting it with Genesis, with the blessing of the tree. And then they have also spent a good bit of time connecting it with power. And you're feeling that. Now, this is not the reason. They're not imaginary connections. They're really there. Now, I want to do a thing I didn't do a moment of yet, and that is connect it with the book of Job. Did ever you notice that the lessons of Job will fit all ages, just like the lessons here? Then again, we have the patience of Job and the trial that he passed through. We have in him the long-suffering under abuse. We have his friends, so-called. They were really accusing him. They were judging him. They were suggesting that there is something secret in your life, and that what you're coming through is something because of your sin in your life. And then you have the different illustrations in that book for the shortness of life. The flower of the field, for example, and so on. Those are all in keeping with James. And then you'll notice that Job is very particular about his thoughtfulness for the poor and the needy and the widow. He's very particular that he was keeping the moral law of God even before the law of Moses was given. Now, you'll find that, of course, at the end, that Job's friends were in great danger of coming under God's dealings in judgment. And Job prayed for his friends, and they were spared the danger that they were encountering. Now that fits perfectly with the book that we have been handling here tonight. But Job is one of those who's afflicted, and let him pray. And if you want some help on how to use the tongue wrongly, or at least to avoid using it wrongly, you study the speeches of Job's friends. Well, they use their tongue, but they use it wrongly. And if you want to seek earthly wisdom, you'll see it in Job's friends, because they got all their wisdom from what they observed on earth. I hope you're feeling that. And Job is a man who, with patience, endured the sorrows and trials, and his faith. You listen to it. You don't believe you're getting a hold of that. The trial brought out the genuineness of his faith. He says, Louis Schlemann, yet will I put him. I think there is genuine faith proved of yonder in that Old Testament figure. I see him along that line. There are a number of words now in Job that are unique. And there are some of these in Job, but not anywhere else in the Old Testament that you don't want in other languages. And I hope the Lord will help us that.
step over this rather difficult passage, and that we'll be able to understand what has happened.
Seeing me correctly? Hearing at the back?
Let's put this thing high up the side. Tell these good men to tie up.
I hope we're all agreed that verse 10 gives us the link with what is developed for the rest of the chapter. That is, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of the Lord. Oh, I have a list of words that you'd expect to find in it. Well, I wouldn't like to give them more here. For instance, the word love, the iron love, is not in the epistle. The word saints is not in the epistle. There's no reference to the cross, to the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. That's not in it. And even the rapture idea of things is not in it. I know the word coming is mentioned. And we have a lot of things that's not in it. And the reason I judge for that is that it's being written to give us some idea of the right conduct to be manifest in those who believe in God in difficult conditions. Now that's what is stressed in the Holy Epistle. As you know, the emphasis is on faith instead of hope or love, and it's stressing the importance of faith. And faith has a way of producing conduct that is in keeping with the category of God. Well, that would be all right. Yes, we'll let you have that, yes. Now we get down to verse 11. Speak not evil one of another, brother.
The idea that you've mentioned of pride in verse number 10 is supported by the thought of speak not down. There's an intensive force there that says speaking down upon another. From your height of superiority, you're speaking down malicious words, isn't that the idea? Mm-hmm. To undermine their position and so on.
Thank you, man.
If she adds then, speak not harshly, would be the opening of verse 11 of another. Don't speak in his absence to his hurt. Don't criticize or insult or slander your neighbor.
Mm-hmm. That again, I think I maybe should have done this, but sorry, but I should have done this, but I didn't do it in the opening remarks. Show how many connections there are in the end part that we were studying just this evening with the earlier part of the epistle. Here we're into speaking, and as you know, that has to do with the tongue. Here's a wrong use of the tongue. Yeah. Yeah. You might have noticed that in my opening remark was this. If he is walking according to the perfect law of liberty, and I complain about the way he's living, I'm then seeing that the law that's directing him is not the law that it should be, and therefore I'm sitting in judgment on the law. You see the view that he's in that. And the rest of you take that view.
Yes.
Yes, he's interfering with the prerogative of God.
Yes. But that the man is actually...
good kind of thing.
Can you hear me now?
No. Is that all right?
I wouldn't send them harm. Thank you. It's our duty not to sit in judgment on the law, but to carry it out and to obey it, so that we are to the doers of the law and not judges, taking up the seat that God alone can occupy. Well, I wouldn't say just Old Testament truth, but there is a sense in which the word law is used where we make a distinction between the ceremonial law and the ethical law, the law of God, in this sense that Paul comes to the same conclusion, that the righteousness of the law is fulfilled in us, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. So that what we would put is this, that while salvation delivers us from the law as a taskmaster, yet the requirements of the law and the standard of the law being God's character revealed, we must remember that, that's reproduced in the Christian in the power of the Holy Spirit.
Not necessarily under the law, but I think that these children who harm them in the Ten Commandments.
I think that the teachings of the law are a revelation of God's character. What we need to watch is this, that the mere knowing of law will not enable us to carry it out. It takes the power of the Holy Spirit to enable the believer to practice the standard of the law.
What about the law that remembered the Sabbath day to the foolish? We have not much problem with that in North America. We have tremendous problems with the Sabbath day. Where do you have the doctrine of the life of the believer?
Well, I don't see that here.
The epistle is the epistle which will deal with all the commandments except the Sabbath. The 100 grace is to keep them, whereas under law we could never do that. So that's significant that the Sabbath is omitted in the epistle, but
yes,
they're there in the New Testament.
Yes, I've noticed that. Yeah, go ahead.
But I was going to say, please, because the one in relation to the Sabbath is the sensation of the other or not.
Very good. Well, it's more and more that we're dealing with in this passage. Now, we'll have to move on, brethren, because I know you've been wanting to get at these difficult parts. Now, it's God's prerogative to save or to destroy. That is, we have no power to carry out judgment. We have no authority to do it. We might have power to do hurt to hurt people, but we have no authority to do it. But it's God's prerogative to either save or destroy. So that we must never step up, as it were. The late Mr. Gilmer said it was all right preaching about the judgment seat of Christ, but don't sit down on it.
I never do.
You see what I'm at now?
Yes,
that's taking the place of the judge.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
so every time a believer judges, acts in judgment on another believer, however minor it is, you're taking the place of God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just proper doing it, shouldn't it?
It should.
It's a serious matter, yet it's done all the time.
It's very serious in the Old Testament. The psalmist said in the 101st Psalm, "Whoso slandereth his neighbor shall be cut off." So the psalmist recognized it as being a very serious thing.
Now, we've dealt with that fairly well. Now, we'll start at verse 13 and we'll get at this business transaction here, going to certain city and buying and selling and get gain and so on. something to say on that, brethren? Yes. Boast not thyself of tomorrow. That's what our brother has in mind. That's another link with the proverb. Boast not thyself of tomorrow, for thou knowest not what a day will bring forth.
So that the worldliness now is seen in another way. Not just seen in the wars that spring from the lust within the human heart. Not only seen in the words by which we criticize and pass from criticism to condemnation of our brethren, not taking the place of the judge, but it's seen in this particular way where wealth has become the key to the interest of our heart, and we show an independent spirit. And we're going to organize our life around this point. We are going to arrange to be in a place for a period, for a particular purpose, to get gain. So this is another element in the worldliness that came to see. Yeah.
So it's the desire for gain that drives the person onto this situation.
And the boosting, when it has been made.
Oh yes.
That was a good day, you know, the way they say, well, that's a good stroke of business.
So the desire for gain drives people on to plan apart from God.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to plan for years there, for future boomers.
He says he doesn't need enemies when he's a friend like you. Well, some of us to keep us free from that, dear brother, as we can.
We want all that's possible.
And that means that many of us say we're not preaching at all because we can't just give the 6 months advance notice. And it's become increasingly difficult, increasingly so. Over the past year, that used to be weeks were thought heavily out, and then months were thought serious out. And brother asked,
"We're taking the place of God,
mm-hmm.
and that's just what it's doing, isn't it? It's a serious matter. It's done all the time.
It's very serious in the Old Testament. The psalmist said in the 101st Psalm, whoso slandereth his neighbor shall be cut off." So the psalmist recognized it as being a very serious thing.
Now, we've dealt with that fairly well. Now, we'll start at verse 13 and we'll get at this business transaction here, going to such and such a city and buying and selling and get gain and so on. Is there something to say on that, brother? Yes. Boast not thyself of tomorrow. That's what our brother has in mind. That's another link with the proverb. Boast not thyself of tomorrow, for thou knowest not what a day will bring forth.
So that the worldliness now is seen in another way. Not just seen in the wars that spring from the lust within the human heart. Not only seen in the words by which we criticize and pass from criticism to condemnation of our brethren, thus taking the place of the judge. But it's seen in this particular way where wealth has become the key to the interest of our heart, and we show an independent spirit. And we're going to organize our life around this point. We are going to arrange to be in a place for a period, for a particular purpose, to get gain. So this is another element in the worldliness that came to see. Yeah.
So this desire for gain that drives the person onto this situation.
And the boasting when it has been made.
Oh yes.
That was a good day, you know, the way they say, well, that's a good stroke of business.
So the desire for gain drives people on to plan apart from God.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to plan for years there for people doing that.
He says he doesn't need enemies when he's a friend like you. Well, some of us to keep us free from that, dear brother, as we can.
We want all that's possible.
And that means that many of us say we're not preaching at all because we can't just give the 6 months advance notice. And it's become increasingly difficult, increasingly so. Over the past year, that used to be weeks were thought heavily out, and then months were thought serious out. A brother asked me in Belfast one time, he said, would you be free around Christmas for a Lord's Day? I said, which Christmas do you mean? I would never have dreamt of that time. It was in the summertime. I never would have thought of where I'd be at Christmas. I wouldn't have known. But now it has become years.
get a man 2 years ahead. All the thing filled up on these. The main concern is filling all that up for years. Now, we need to be careful. What it is doing is it's making it very difficult to get some kind of brother free for the comfort or the conference or the Belfast meetings or anything like that. It's becoming increasingly difficult. I'm not going to be hard on it. I'm on earth the same as you. And brother, I know, and if you go the year, well, I go 2 years, if you're not through that year, you're free, not year, if you're not year, we'll get that year, and before you know where you are, you're 4 or 5 years ahead, and you know not what will be in the morrow. And you have come very close, isn't it? And just tomorrow.
But this verse 15 says, if the Lord will, we ought to say,
yeah,
if the Lord will.
Ah, well, Mayor, if you know the Lord will for 4 years, hang here, very good. No, he didn't. That's not in the business. It's a business problem here. Now, it's a man planning to sell and get gain, buy and sell and get gain. Now, we need to be careful about that, because James would teach us very plainly that there could be wrong desires in our heart, and this would be one of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
Fit in very well here. He is an eternity. That's a very good
illustration.
Now we go on here now to for what is your life? Now that links back with chapter 1, where you're the flower of the field that vanishes away, isn't that right? Chapter 1 was that, right? So that we're back again thinking along those lines. Now here it's a vapor. Just a mist or a cloud that blows off and it's gone. Appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. Now that is, I don't know if any of you remember hearing an address in the Easter meetings on this verse, which you all do, that were there, and that made out that life without God is an empty thing, just like a vapor. I didn't hear that preached in it, I don't see that then, but I mean that was preached it, you know. I can remember it well, I tell you it's already preached it. These computers are all new. Go ahead.
Verse 17, please. In that law to do good, and do it not, to him it is sin. How important is it? In the case of taking the law of liberty and so forth, I'm going to do that. If you see a holy illustration, the Bible reading is good, and I do go sin. The prayer reading is good. I don't know. Sin.
I hadn't maybe thought so. I thought it was doing an act of good. That's really here. Now, I'm not saying that all those things are right. That's staying away. That's certainly not right. But I've thought that quite often the believer is inclined. Now, we're all inclined, and even sinners are greatly inclined, to only look upon sin as things that are wrongly done. For as this verse teaches us that other side of things,
And indeed, most of our sins are sins of omission rather than sins of commission. Sins that we have left, things we should have done and didn't do. Oftentimes we have a thought in our mind and God has laid it on our heart to do something. And we just fail to do it. It maybe doesn't suit us to do it or something like that. Well, that would be sin against God. Every believer knows what it is to just fail to do what he ought to do. Young believer knows that it's right to be baptized. Well, if he refuses to do that, he's grieving God. So that we need to be careful that we don't try to limit our sin in our confession plan to the wrongs that we have done, but to the good that we have failed to do. We ought to equally confess that before God.
Is it linking back to verse 15, those who say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that, they know what they should do according to the Lord's will. If they don't do it,
that's what I said in the opening remarks, that it's a man that knows what God wills him to do and yet refuses to do it. But it is stressing a line of things that we don't hear much about, and that is the seriousness of omission in our life.
Is the doing good disservice of him? That's the prayer of the penitent, that their life is not our life in God's hand, and the doing evil is that every dragon thought that we have in verse 16, boasting, and it's empty boasting of that's not doing evil, that's not doing evil. So that it's the spirit of dependence upon God, isn't it?
Yes. That humble spirit that just does God's will and happy to do it.
Is there any wider interpretation of if the Lord will, other than circumstances changing, and we take it as the other ruling of the Lord? Is there any expression on that, Lord? Would that be as far as we can go?
You mean that you're being guided only by circumstances? But there are many, many decisions that we have to make, and we have to seek the Lord's will about them. Now, that's a very big subject. Very big. I would say one of the biggest that the child of God has to ponder, because it's quite simple to me when it comes to things that God commands and the Bible teaches. I have no problem with that at all. There's God's will and that ends it. No talk or argument about it. But there's many decisions that we have to make. For instance, a man has to change his job, and should he change his assembly, or should he go to live in some other country? All these matters are very big and very serious. It would take a whole big conference for to give any help at all, really, in the detail of how a man is directed to find out the will of God, and then to know what he ought to do. Now, I don't think that mysterious side of things, or that difficult side of things, is just before us here. I think it's something that we should know. That's the Lord's will, and if he be his will, then I'll do what he bids me, and I'm on his hand.
But does it not emphasize the course of a man who has succumbed to worldliness and the spirit of independence that's in the world? Whereas the believer in fellowship with God, in light of Psalm 32, I will guide thee with mine eye. There is that communion and fellowship that doesn't exist in the world and its ways and its things and its business. But the believer is conscious that what the Lord desires, it's not, as you know here, the determinant of will, it's the desire of the heart of God, what God wills for me in this particular circumstance. It's contra. It's the contra to the worldliness that's in the human heart.
Would you say, brother, that it includes prayer, circumstances, the Word of God, and the prophecy of the Holy Spirit? That would be some help, wouldn't it?
Yes, you've covered her up there.
And then, in the day, there were four of the brethren, good brethren, the best of brethren.
Who?
We never hear their voice on the Lord's Day morning, given thanks at the Lord's table.
And
they know it's wrong. Is that
sin,
or is it not?
No, you're going to have us judging. The fact that we'll be sitting judgment on judgment on others, so we better be careful. We're not just that big group now, but I know all right, my brother. One thing you need to know is, if the Lord, you believe it, the Lord will to do, so creation has something to do in all humility. And that's the best reason to say. And we're not all this clear as to what exactly to do, that some men know everything, but I don't. And we're hoping for the sake in all humility, I bow me through thy will, O God, and all thy ways adore,
I wonder if we really truthfully think that. I hope we do. Not that they keep us right in the script. Now, we're no half-limbers in chapter 5, because this is really the difficulty that we hope. Now, we'll get to the written man again here, for those who are not. In chapter 4, we have those who are seeking wealth. In chapter 5, we have those who possess it, and misuse it, and ill-treat the poor in the doing of it. I don't think the rich men are Christians.
I was just going to ask you that. Do you think these boys are in the assembly?
Not at all. I don't think that's as just rich as rich as it lasts.
In fact, he's using a literary device of apostrophe, addressing those who are not present for the benefit of those who are.
Yes. Very good. And again, do not rich men oppress you. Again, we're going back over the epistle again. Now here's where the rich men are doing that.
Mm-hmm. He's going to describe the character of the society in which believers will have to determine the will of God, in which they'll have to wait for the Lord in His coming. And he's going to show the character of the background society. And he's going to touch on the material, he's going to look behind the material to the method, he's going to look behind the method to the motive. And he's going to show just what the world is like in its very essence.
Mm-hmm.
And I read chapter 14. The devil, Lucifer, to the end, and is recorded in our Bible, but not for the benefit or for the instruction of Lucifer. And then is addressed in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. But it's just as a brother pointed out, it's addressing something in a literary way. No, actually, for an encouragement for the Lord's people. It's now recorded for them, and the rich are now being held up. And it's a declaration, it's not saying you rich men in the assembly go through now. It's just simply a statement addressing the rich on the transitoriness of their riches and them, and it's to encourage the Lord's people, both of them, in their poverty.
Now, one of the warnings that is involved in the verses is the fact that such wealth is disappearing, going to be taken from them, and that they're reckoning for the judgment of God. That's why they're to weep and howl. They're to lament at the very thought that they are going to come into great misery under the judging hand of God. You see, your gold and silver is cankered, and the rust of them shall be a witness against you, and ye shall eat your flesh as it were fire. That is, all that they hold dear is going to be consumed. It's already, as it were, decaying in their very hands. So what the writer is trying to show us is that there's no use of getting so excited about earthly riches and all that kind of thing, for people who have them are going to lose them, and they're not worth keeping.
The present tense in the verb in the first verse are coming upon you, almost abuse the whole thing as coming upon them now. You can't escape it, it's really on the move, it's moving towards you.
The word misery sometimes translated hardship, which is the reverse of the riches. You know, you're enjoying the pleasure and the comfort of the riches, but there are times of hardship, and they're coming toward you now.
It's prophetic, isn't it, really? Because this was about AD 45, and AD 70 it happened.
Yes, I thought it definitely of the destruction of Jerusalem and the overcoming of the land. This would be literally fulfilled in their day. And yet even in this day, riches and they're not worthy of any attention.
There will be another destruction after the Lord has taken hold of his church.
Yes.
And therefore it has a double perspective. The three bad things are grain, garment, and gold and silver. So these things that they put so much trust in. And the grain's not mentioned here, it's mentioned by the Lord in Matthew 6, but the word is corrupted. That's the word that speaks of the decay. And so the garments are moth-eaten, and the other is gold and silver is rusted. Did James not know that the noble metals don't rust?
That's a pity. No, I take it that all these things are just, let us see, that the best, you see, not redeemed with corruptible things. Peter was just as dark as he was. Not redeemed with corruptible things as silver and gold. these men knew that metals were even with all their qualities, they just don't last forever. And they're, even they do last, they're not allowed to stay with them. Very good. Agree with that, yes.
As in other places in Scripture, when the warning of tribulation to come, there's also encouragement given before it comes that their cries will be heard by the Lord of surveillance.
Yeah.
The one who will hear, the one able to meet their need. That's the same for those in the future day who will be suffering. They're told that their cries will be heard. We must not forget that.
The way in which the gold and the garments have been gathered and turned the joy of harvest into sorrow, and that makes their gold corrupt. It's been gotten by ill gain, it's been gotten by oppression. So the corrupted gold, the corrupted riches, even though we know that these are messages of corruption.
You see, the verse 4 takes us on to another side of things. Behold the hire of the laborers who have reaped your fields. This is how they made their wealth, and they did it at the expense of others who were defrauded by them, and who cried unto the Lord of hosts that he would help them and deliver them from these cruel, ill-treating men.
You can see their miserly habits. You keep treasure together in the last day.
Yes.
The
right, watch that, you younger ones, watch that. It's not for the last days. It's not a man laying up money for his old age sort of thing. It's in the last days. These days that are so critical, as our brother has pointed out, they were living just at the eve of the destruction of their land, so that their riches and all would be taken away by their enemy. Well, as you all know, that's a title that was introduced into your Bible in the books of Samuel, and not until then is it used. And it seems as if we might think these are lordly men, and they have power in their hand, and they can be ill-treating the poor and needy, and abusing them and killing them and so on. But there's one who's in control of all the hosts and has no limit of power at his disposal to deal with his enemies.
Is there not support for the ones that have been robbed of their wages in that title, the Lord of Sabaoth? I mean, is it not a sense in which there are ample resources with him, and he can reward them for what they have lost down here? Is that not a sense in it?
Well, there could be that in it, but I have thought it was particularly his power to deal with those that the saints were helpless to touch.
Yes.
They were submissive to them.
Yes.
You see, the temptation, as you know, when people are being abused, would be to use swear words, as we'll see later on, and to murmur, that's another temptation, and to have ill feelings toward those who were oppressing them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's just teaching them what Paul taught the Romans, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. You leave that to God to deal with, because he will do it. He'll deal with it. Okay. Well, certainly that is true. He wasn't closing his eyes to the ill treatment, and he was the one who will control things and definitely deal with their enemies.
And to have a little
Well, I remember what I've been saying just now about the Lord. Recompensing. So that we wouldn't become too old-fresh or e-fresh, such a ministry. There's an encouragement in the epistles as well as in Paul's epistles. We can be rich in faith, and that will produce faithfulness. And the Lord will say, well done, good and faithful servant. In Timothy's letter, we can be rich in good works, and the good works will be rewarded as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say that there's two cries here. There's the cries of the wages, the scream of the wages reaching the ear of the Lord. And that would answer to the blood of Abel crying unto me from the ground. Injustice cries to high heaven, wherever it's found. And then there's the cry of the people who have been oppressed, like the cries of Israel in Egypt, that reached the ear of God and became down to the level.
And then they're weeping and crying in the first verse. That's their upcoming to them. Their day of weeping is becoming. There may be cries in the needy now, but their day of weeping is coming when the judgment falls.
Just one thing. It is given the judgment from the king back to the crucifix and not
I don't think that, I don't take that view now. I don't know what our other brethren take. I don't think it's, I know it is the just one, but I thought it was a representative one of the righteous and the just being put to death. That's the full length that they could go. They killed the innocent and the righteous in the pursuit of their wealth and prosperity.
This would almost have been a prophetic statement for James himself, wouldn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Would it be that behind it he says, now you use judicial murder, you use the tribunals, the judgment seat of chapter 2, use those and drag the souls before, and then they executed them judicially for murder.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what happened to James himself, according to Josephus, AD 62. The high priest of that year, taking advantage of the Roman procurator being away, he dragged James before the judgment seat, condemned him, put him to death, and stoned him to death.
So he's actually writing his own death warrant, as he was saying here.
You would see James writing prophetic.
Uh-huh. Now, the point we have to deal with is verse 7. Be patient, therefore, brethren. That is what way were we going to act under this cruel treatment? He says, now be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth, and hath long patience, and so on, for the rain, and so on. That is just as the husbandman waits for the refreshing showers of the rain, and those reviving showers of rain. These suffering saints waited patiently for the Lord who was at the door and for his coming, and that would bring a refreshment and deliverance to them.
Would it be necessary to point out that the word patient here is be patient with men, with the society? It's not the word endure that we get further on down. It's to endure what men heap upon us. The word that used of God, long suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we should, that has led us into another line of things. We should notice that there are two distinct words in the passage that would be very close. Patience, and a brother has put endurance on it, and he has put long suffering. Now, the long suffering word is used extensively, and then you've heard of the patience of Job. Now, that's a distinct word from the long suffering. That word is never used by God. The distinction between the two names is something like this. A brother seems to have in his mind, which is quite fairly often correct, and that is the long suffering has to do with men. Generally speaking, not always, but generally with men. We endure conditions. Now, God can be long suffering and patient with individuals. Thank God he was not patient with me, and he was patient with you. Or we would never have been saved. He long suffering. But he is never to endure anything in the sense that Job had to endure his affliction, because God's not controlled through by circumstances. He's above circumstances. So circumstances never become impossible for him to get out of or anything like that. He's never in such condition. So Well, these are the two different words that are used.
Mm-hmm. You said that yesterday, yeah? The rain doesn't bother John. It certainly bothers you and me. Sometimes.
Yes.
Right.
So the coming of the Lord, the change it's referring to, is the coming of the Lord?
Yes, I thought it was coming to execute judgment on all them that obey him. I didn't think it was a rapture state of things that he had in mind.
But we would not have
stood for that. Exactly.
After all, for the sense, it must include the ram up for the refreshing rains and so on.
Yes. And looking at us is from our angle, that is coming down to us, we are looking for that rapture.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in my mind, Lord, at that time, the fruit of the rapture is not being poured, had it?
Except that they knew that the Lord was coming back again, he said so himself, but in what way in time, that is not the point, is it? It's just a general statement, the Lord is coming, comfort yourselves with that, you know, in the circumstances.
Yes, it's the presence of the Lord will make all the difference.
He's right. Present
now, and he's the present then.
That's right.
The aspect of the coming being achieved is possibly with restitution, and the new improvements are given up, and these are matters in the Lord's hand. Why, it's certainly in harmony with the fruit of action, but the intensity is on this coming in another day.
No problem.
Okay, look at one.
But will his coming not mean that the judge will not only be at the door, but he'll come through the door, as we would say? When we think of a thing at the door in his near hand, it's not what you think that's the meaning there. So the Lord's near, as it were, and that would be a great comfort to these people. You know, we probably, the real reason why we maybe don't value the Lord's coming the way we ought to is quite often our circumstances are so comfortable that we're not really as burdened about it or thoughtful about it. But many of the old saints that have to suffer a good wee bit of hardship, they just felt, well, now, maybe the last day I'll have it to do, it'll be here in the morning maybe, and before the night is out, and it'll be all over. And that was a great cheer to them in the midst of their trial.
Mm-hmm. Is that why the door is in the plural? That each one of them would feel his personal, the effect of his coming personally.
I haven't noticed that, I'm sorry.
It is, yeah.
It is, isn't it?
Different plural.
We associate progress with early and latter, early on in our lives, spiritual life, physical life. Would you associate, we have to work with the Lord, we've got to make sure that we're fully mature. With the early rains and the latter rains. You, low rains,
I haven't thought of that way, dear brother. I must admit I am Mr. Bill.
Go ahead.
Well, I had thought that possibly, maybe, is there the thought of the diaspora here, and the seed dropped into the ground, the implanted word that he had had earlier, and maturing in believers and the full development of their character? Now, you drop that seed in, and it seems to be crushed, and then what would you expect? The fruit? No, but before the fruit had come, the two stages, the thunderstorm, the first, the early rains or the heavy rains, and then the latter rains, the lighter rains. And all to the maturing of the fruit.
Mm-hmm.
So that the husbandman, I see it as God, as it were, in the picture, has planted the seed, allows the circumstances to mature the fruit, and when it's ripe, he takes it home. Now you be patient. Is that so?
But I thought it's the husbandman that's taken here. For he's wondering, he knows he has sown the seed, and he depends upon God to send him the early and latter rain to see it through.
Is it not the husbandman that's doing it every year?
Yes, but he's enjoying the sense to be taken.
Yes,
the husbandman has to do the waiting too. But that, to me, is irrelevant to the instruction.